The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Right, so the Hyde Amendment, which is named after the late Henry Hyde, who was the great pro-life Republican from the state of Illinois, is an annual, a biannual amendment that's included in the budget, which prohibits Medicaid funds, so federal funding from Medicaid, for going to pay for elective abortion procedures.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That was Mary Hallin Fiorito, and she joined the broadcast this past Friday. We spoke to her to break down the news that the Hyde Amendment was left out of the new budget. Look, it's a shame. When that news broke, I immediately wanted to cover it for you. It's a shameful move. I hope you're praying for this administration. I hope you're praying for our country. And I'm not saying that in a divisive way. I just think that there's a real blindness spiritually. There's an intellectual arrogance and blindness there, too. When President Biden submitted his proposed budget for the next fiscal year, those who were in the pro-life movement, they knew right away. I mean, they knew instantly there was going to be major problems with it. They knew it, you know. They knew even before he released it that the Hyde Amendment was more than likely to be axed. And sure enough, when it came out Friday, what happened? The Hyde Amendment was nowhere to be found. Right? And this comes from a Catholic president. I'll take that off the table. I'll stop saying that for a little bit. It just drives me crazy. I don't know about you. I mean, it really does. It pushes my button. It hits a real sore spot for me. I mean, you might say, well, what's the Hyde Amendment? The Hyde Amendment, if you're not familiar with it, it's an amendment that forbids direct federal funding of abortions. And it was added to the budget every year for decades, all the way back to 1980. And every single president included it in his budget proposal, except for, I think it was just one time in 1993 when Bill Clinton didn't add it. But fundamentally, Democrat and Republican across the board, yeah, it was there. But, he learned his lesson pretty quickly, and every budget proposal that he submitted had it in there in the future. Even Barack Obama, even the Obama administration had it in all 8 of his proposals. What is going on with Joe Biden? Can somebody tell me that? The Biden-Harris administration, right? We'll see how this plays out. It was pretty clear that President Biden, who voted for the Hyde Amendment when he was a senator, by the way, he voted for it. He wouldn't keep it, even when the bishops knew it was going to happen, because they sent out a press release immediately after the news broke, which is unusual for them. Remember, they give a little bit of time. But again, Joe Biden's a Catholic. The bishops immediately responded. Archbishop Joseph Nauman, who is the chairman of the Pro-Life Committee, he said this. I'll share one quick quote with you. He said, Congress must reject the administration's proposal to subsidize the deaths of unborn children. For nearly half a century, the Hyde Amendment and related provisions have protected taxpayers from funding most abortions. I don't want my tax dollars going there. I don't know about you. I'd rather see my money used in some other way. I certainly don't want my hard-earned tax dollar going for the destruction of the most vulnerable of our citizenry. So Nauman goes on and says, these policies have broad support for Democrats and Republicans. They've been enacted and signed into law by Congress and presidents of both political parties and have been broadly supported by the majority of low-income women, including women of color. That's where we are today. Charlotte Lozier Institute, their president there is a guy named Chuck Donovan. He explained to Jeannie Mancini of the March for Life just how important the Hyde Amendment has been in saving lives. And again, Biden administration wants nothing to it. Listen to this.
Well, we've talked a little bit about the fact that publicly funded abortion was happening in the 1970s, pretty much by default. The Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, it was then called, looked at the statute apparently and said medically necessary, abortion is now legal, therefore it's going to be funded with federal dollars. So that was the entire United States. So that was taking place. I'm sure it helped drive the abortion rate up. And it was a discovery by one or two lobbyists And one great legislator, may he rest in peace, Henry Hyde of Illinois, just a towering figure in the pro-life cause, and he took this issue to the floor of the Congress, offered his amendment, and frankly, it was probably the first time anybody had thought about this taking place. It passed, but immediately went into court. So what you have is a very long history, even after the state, the federal issues were resolved by the Supreme Court and Harris versus McRae. There were still states that decided on their own to fund abortion, or the political wind shifted. So we had quite a chore. But Michael New, Dr. Michael New, who teaches at Ave Maria, is one of our 43 scholars. He went state by state, looking at when the Hyde Amendments in those states were in effect. Obviously, the blanket of the federal Hyde Amendment over that. He also looked at court injunctions, changes by the legislature, the exceptions. And then he applied to that what actually is a low estimate of the effect of the Hyde Amendment. We use Guttmacher data for that because they do not like the Hyde Amendment. They believe it reduces the abortion rate, and they've produced estimates of how many women, as they would put it, lose access because of the Hyde Amendment. So all in all, it's a very exacting report. No one's challenged it. I don't think they can. But what he concluded was that since its enactment, the various forms of the Hyde Amendment have saved 2.13 million human lives. Now, stack that against a lot of other investments we make in public health. The Hyde Amendment may be one of the two or three most important public health measures ever enacted in the United States.
It's my great privilege now to welcome back to the broadcast Michael New. We heard just a moment ago, he's one of those great scholars at the Charlotte Lozier Institute. He's also a research associate at the Bush School at Catholic University of America. And always good to talk with him. Hey, first of all, thank you for what you've done for the cause of life. And thank you for joining me today. This is such an important issue, as we just heard in that last soundbite there.
Drew, thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
So, you know, for those who this might be new to, or they're not really totally plugged in, what exactly does the Hyde Amendment forbid? You know, why does it have to be voted on every year? Why not some other piece of, you know, let's start there. Why every year, and what's it forbid? We'll lay out the basics.
Well, first, I think it's easier to answer the second question first. So the Hyde Amendment limits the ability of the federal government to fund abortions through the Medicaid program. We have a Medicaid program that provides health insurance to low-income earners, covers different things, and essentially what the Hyde Amendment does is it limits the ability of the federal government to pay for abortions through the Medicaid program. Now, why does that be passed every year? Essentially because every year the federal government appropriates money for Medicaid. So there's an annual appropriation that the government funds itself every year through appropriations bills. And essentially, there's one appropriation bill, that funds the Department of Health and Human Services, that funds Medicaid. So essentially, every time money is appropriated, this Hyde Amendment has to be put in place to make sure that the appropriated money doesn't fund elective abortions. So again, it's part of the budget process. You know, Congress has to pass a budget every year. So since budgeting is an annual process, we have to pass the Hyde Amendment every year to make sure that, again, elective abortions aren't paid for with taxpayer dollars through the Medicaid program.
So, you know, give me a little history here, too. I mean, what's up with Joe Biden? I mean, he voted for the Hyde Amendment, right, when he was a senator. What happened along the way? I mean, how did he change his position so radically on this issue?
Yes, it's not only did he vote for the Hyde Amendment. I mean, he used to brag about this. I mean, there is a online, people can Google around, someone has unearthed a letter he wrote to a constituent where he bragged that he voted against tax-free funding of abortion no fewer than 50 times. So he was always someone who took a lot of pride in voting against tax-free funding for abortion. So he didn't, you know, hide his support from the Hyde Amendment. He was very clear that he supported the Hyde Amendment as a U.S. senator. What happened? A couple of things. First, he decided to run for president. Secondly, the Democratic Party started a shift on sanctity of life issues, which is unfortunate. I think there are some demographic shifts within the Democratic Party that have shifted that party more to the left. I think for a long time, Democrats had to win a lot of older voters who came of age during the Great Depression and World War II. A lot of these older Democrats were perhaps more liberal on economic issues. They might have supported Medicare and Medicaid. They might have supported unions. But a lot of these older Democrats were socially conservative. So it made sense for a lot of Democrats, like Joe Biden, to support the Hyde Amendment and oppose taxpayer funding of abortion. Now, this older generation of Democrats is kind of passing away. If you were 10 or 9 when the Great Depression happened, you're probably over 100 right now. So a group of older Democrats that came of age during the Great Depression of World War II that were, frankly, more conservative on social issues has passed away, and they're being replaced by a generation of younger Democrats who tend to be a lot more secular and, frankly, a lot more liberal on sanctity of life issues. And this is a voting bloc that supports abortion and it supports tax-free funding of abortion. And that's why Joe Biden and a lot of Democrats have now changed their position. And it's unfortunate. I mean, the Hyde Amendment used to enjoy a great deal of bipartisan support. As you mentioned, 7 of the 8 budgets proposed by President Clinton include the Hyde Amendment. All 8 budgets proposed by President Obama include the Hyde Amendment. When the Hyde Amendment was first voted on in 1976, 107 House Democrats voted in favor. As recently as 1993, 98 House Democrats voted in favor of the Hyde Amendment. So the Hyde Amendment has a history of bipartisan support, and it's really sad that Joe Biden and other Democrats are now opposing this life-saving bill.
So, you know, where's the country on this? You know, I know that sometimes those who hold public office, you know, they advance their own progressive ideology or whatever they feel is important. I mean, what do the polls show? Where are people in terms of their support of the amendment?
Well, the good news is that, you know, most Americans oppose tax-free funding for abortion, that the Hyde Amendment always polls well. I did some research, and I've come across 8 nationwide surveys that have been conducted since the summer of 2016. 7 of the 8 show that a plurality of Americans oppose tax-free funding for abortion, and 7 of the 8 show that a majority oppose taxpayer funding for abortion. So the Hyde Amendment always polls well. You know, people are split about whether abortion should be legal or illegal, but polls show pretty consistently that majorities of Americans really don't want to see their tax dollars paying for abortion.
So are there other items right now in the budget that pro-lifers need to be concerned about?
Yeah, absolutely. This budget, frankly, is a big giveaway to Planned Parenthood and supporters of legal abortion. And I can go through several things. Yeah. This budget calls for the repeal of the Dornan Amendment. And that means that the D.C. Medicaid program will be able to cover elective abortions. So that probably means we'll have hundreds of more abortions taking place in the nation's capital. This budget also calls for a 19% increase in Title X family planning funding. So that likely means that Planned Parenthood will get tens of millions of additional taxpayer dollars. This budget also calls for a 72% increase for the United Nations Population Fund. And the UNFP supports abortion. It also supports the Chinese government's population control activities that include forced abortion. So there's a lot of things in this budget that should really concern pro-lifers. It really is a big giveaway to Planned Parenthood and supporters of legal abortion.
My guest today is Michael Ngo. If you want to join us, I only have him for a moment or two. You can dial in at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Yeah, I know that there are probably a lot of people who think that, hey, what can I do? You know, these guys are in office. I'm kind of powerless. What can we do personally? I always raise that question because, you know, I feel that way sometimes, you know, and I know what I do is I pray. Sometimes I'll call my elected officials. Sometimes I'll give air to an issue because I have a microphone. But what can the average person do right now in terms of trying to make a difference here?
Well, first of all, don't despair. The proposal is just that, a proposal. The president's budget really contains no legal weight. It just shows what the president would like to see the budget look like. So this is kind of an opening salvo, and I think what's going to be a longer conflict over the budget. So, again, it's just a proposal. You know, nothing has changed as of yet. Secondly, best you can do is absolutely, you know, call your congressman. Even if your congressman is a Democrat, if your congressman supports legal abortion, you know, make your voice heard. You know, your congressman represents you. And frankly, you know, your congressman want to win re-election. And if they're getting lots of calls from angry constituents who don't want their taxpayer dollars going to abortion, you know, they will listen. So definitely, you know, call your congressman. Also, you know, get active on social media. Communicate with your friends and your peers. Let them know what's happening. you know, follow good groups like Susan B. Anthony List, like the Lotus Institute, like Live Action, like Students for Life.
Right.
I mean, we're going to be very active on this issue. You know, we think this fight is winnable. You know, essentially we'll be doing things online like Tweet Fest and other activities on social media to get the word out, take part in that. You know, we need all the help we can get. So I think, again, it's important not to despair. I think it's history is instructive.
Yeah.
Again, 28 years ago, President Clinton proposed a budget that did not include the Hyde Amendment.
Yeah.
But we got the Hyde Amendment passed that year. Henry Hyde showed a lot of leadership. He did find, again, 98 House Democrats to support the Hyde Amendment,
yeah.
And the Hyde Amendment was saved. And again, you know, margins in the House and Senate are very narrow.
Yeah.
We just need a handful of Democrats to flip. And some of these Democrats represent conservative districts. So, again, people need to make their voices heard. This fight is winnable, but pro-lifers need to be active and engaged.
Amen to that. Oh, Michael, thank you for all that you're doing with the Lozier Institute, of course, there at CUA with the Bush School. Hey, people want to follow you on Twitter. I know that you you tweet all the time, @Michael_J_new. That's N-A-W, @Michael_J_new. And I'm grateful for your time and your perspective, too. We'll stay on top of this and all the news that continues to unfold. And keep up your good fight, okay?
All right. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. That's Michael New, associate scholar there. I got to take a short pause. When we come back, we can talk more. I know you can feel, you sometimes feel like me, outgunned, overwhelmed. You think this is never going to end. I like what he said. He said, don't despair. I don't despair. You know what? I don't despair. I get bummed out when I see what happens with this administration and where my taxpayer dollars are going and the direction the country's heading and, you know, what happens. But, you know, when God's on your side, and God is on your side, you know why? Because God's on the side of life. You are on the right side of history. All these yahoos who are advancing this culture of death, who are promoting abortion, funding abortion, who are promoting things like the Equality Act, advancing euthanasia, all these things that are diametrically opposed to God's law, to natural law, they're on the wrong side of history. Good conquers evil. You know, good conquers evil. And I believe we'll see it in our time. We'll see it in our day. Sometimes it gets dark before the dawn. It's darkest before the dawn, right? I think the sun's soon going to rise. And with your prayers, your sacrifices, your action, we'll see that.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
More than 1 million New York State vaccine passports have been downloaded onto phones and computers since the platform launched in March. The New York Times reported Tuesday that approximately 1.1 million Excelsior passes have been issued as of last week since the start of the voluntary program in March.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Does that news from the Hill surprise you? Good afternoon. I thought we'd talk a little bit about the latest regarding COVID. Whether or not you're going to need a vaccine passport or even a vaccine booster shot. I saw an article earlier today where you might be able to mix and match your shots. You're saying, what? I thought I had to take Pfizer. I took Moderna. Well, I'll tell you what's going on. We'll fill you in on that. And is it possible that we might do away with vaccinations in the arm? It might be under the tongue. I'll fill you in on some really interesting news. But right now, if you want to get in, the number here is 888-914-9149. Just a quick programming note before we dive into vaccine passports and your booster shot. If you want to share this conversation, if you heard something that you liked or you said, man, I wish I could listen to that again, simply go to relevantradio.com and you can check out our podcast, okay? My show will be up there. Jake normally gets today's broadcast up about an hour after I sign off. But you can go back for months of conversation. And we've talked about all sorts of really wonderful things, and I hope you will share with others this broadcast. If you find what I share on the air here compelling, informative, inspiring, educational, then tell somebody else, and be sure to join me. Set your watch, set your phone, and join me every afternoon. I'm 2 to 5 Central, 3 to 6 Eastern, noon to 3 Pacific, wherever you're listening. You know, I'd love to hang out with you. Let me fill you in on what's happening with COVID. I know we've been talking about this forever, right? I'm hoping there'll be a day where this is just a memory. We're celebrating anniversaries, and we won't be talking about new developments. But right now, millions of people have received their vaccine. I don't know whether you've had your shot yet or not, whether you're going to get it or not. I get emails from people saying, why are you convincing people to get the vaccine? I got other people saying, people shouldn't get the vaccine. You know, I get it from both ends. Vaccine makers are saying this. So if you have the shot, I'm speaking to anybody who's gotten the vaccine already. They're saying that people who have them, you're probably going to need to get a booster shot. All right, you're going to need to get a third shot potentially. And they're also starting experiments that they're calling mix and match. And this is what really struck me. And in a moment, Dr. Barbara Golder is going to be stopping by. I want to tap into her expertise here. For instance, just give you an example. If you got the Pfizer shot and you say, well, you know, they don't have Pfizer here or I'm somewhere else, and you want to get the Moderna shot or you know, some other shot, you might be able to do that. They're experimenting on that right now. The Pfizer shot might be related, though, they're saying right now. I saw a story earlier today. It might be related to some heart issues. Some young men in Israel are now experiencing have had that. You know, with any vaccination, there's always some sort of side effect, but that can be a concern, especially if you have heart issues. Reuters reported that Israeli doctors had found a small number of those who were given the Pfizer inflammation, that they or the Pfizer vaccine, they noticed heart inflammation in the young men who received the vaccines. And Pfizer says they haven't seen any, you know, they haven't seen any unusual numbers. So I'm just throwing it out there, something for you to think about. You know, we had clotting issues with Johnson & Johnson. There were some concerns about AstraZeneca. But ever since the CDC, ever since the Center for Disease and Control and Prevention, they suddenly said last month that vaccinated people don't have to wear masks indoors, but vaccinated people do. Policies on this have been all over the map. It's been kind of confusing. Maybe you're a store owner. Maybe you own a restaurant. The stores are the primary places where it's happening. A lot of national chains have dropped the mandates, except for TJ Maxx. I think they saw theirs in place. And I'm not quite sure about some of the hardware stores, the Lowe's, the Home Depot's. Even the Archdiocese of Chicago. I had read that the Archdiocese of Chicago, Cardinal Blaise Supich, has decreed that if you're vaccinated, you can go to Mass without a mask. You can go. I went to Mass today, and people had their masks on. There was a sign on the door that said, wear your mask if you're going to Mass. I'm not in Chicago, but... the Cardinal of Chicago said, you know, if you're vaccinated, you don't need a mask. But you need to show the greeters at the door your vaccine papers. Show me your papers. You know, you got to show your papers to get in the church. You need to show proof that you've been vaccinated if you don't want to wear a mask at Mass. And maybe that's okay. Maybe you're saying, sure, why not? That's cool. That's fair, right? White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, a while back, she said that federally mandated vaccine passports were off the table. And this raises some questions. Will you have to have a vaccine passport in order to get on a plane to fly locally, not just internationally, but from place to place, or to go into a restaurant, or, you know, to go into church in some places? Listen to what Jen Psaki said.
The government is not now, nor will we be supporting a system that requires Americans to carry a credential. There will be no federal vaccinations database and no federal mandate requiring everyone to obtain a single vaccination credential. As these tools are being considered by the private and nonprofit sectors, our interest is very simple from the federal government, which is Americans' privacy and rights should be protected and so that these systems are not used against people unfairly.
Amen. I agree with that. Yeah. Yeah. I want my rights, my privacy protected. On another note, Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, he told ABC's Good Morning America that, look, he's not taking, let me phrase that. He's going to take a look at requiring vaccine passports for international travel. And I'm on the fence on this one. Dr. Golder's going to help me work through this because you know what? When I went to Tanzania or to Ghana or to Rwanda or to many of these other places on the African continent or even to Haiti, you know, one of the poorest nations in the Western Hemisphere, I had to have, you know, my typhoid shot or my Hep A, my Hep B. You know, you had to get all these, you know, cholera. You needed all these different vaccinations. I had my yellow vaccination card, got me into where I needed to go. Is it so wrong to have a vaccination card for international travel? So the Homeland Security Secretary is looking at that. His comments, though, were walked back by someone else in the administration shortly after he said this. Listen.
We're taking a very close look at that. You know, one of our principles that has guided us throughout this pandemic is the value of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and making sure that any passport that we provide for vaccinations is accessible to all and that no one is disenfranchised. And so we're taking a very close look at that. There's an underlying point here, of course, which is everyone should get vaccinated.
You know, the Danish government's come out with a digital vaccine passport so that people can start traveling in the UN after the first of the next month. So you got the Danes there, right? They've got a digital vaccine passport, but only 20% of their population's been fully vaccinated, right? You've probably been following, you know, American news, Florida, right? Cruise lines, they're very anxious to get their ships filled with people and back out to the water, but they're running into trouble right now with a new law, that was signed by the governor of Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis, that bans businesses from asking for vaccine passports. I'm sure, you know, if you're a business owner, you may not want to have people show you their papers, right? To show me their vaccines, your vaccination shots. But DeSantis says, hey, if you're a business, you're not going to have to. But how will that affect the cruise industry? New York, you know, the big state, high population, 16 million people in New York, right? New York is the only state so far that has a vaccine passport available to people. It's called the Excelsior Pass, and it allows people to show what looks like a QR code, right, on their phone. They can, like you scan when you go through the airports to board a plane, right, if you download your boarding pass, right? So you get this little QR code on your phone. It shows your vaccination status. But so far, only about 11% of New Yorkers who have gotten the shots have downloaded the apps. And I think that speaks volumes about people wanting privacy. I'm joined right now by Dr. Barbara Golda. She's not just a physician. She's an attorney and a bioethicist and an award-winning author and the editor-in-chief of the bioethics journal, Lineker Quarterly. And it's good to have her with us today. You can find her online at LadyDocLawyer.com. That's LadyDocLawyer.com. Dr. Golder, thank you for your time. Good afternoon.
My pleasure to be here.
Boy, a lot going on. You know, I thought, gosh, what are you going to talk about regarding COVID? I mean, it never seems to be a shortage of conversation. And I think a skeptic could probably easily question why these companies believe that they're going to need a booster shot. Let's start with the vaccine. When I saw that story, I thought of you and I thought, okay, so Moderna and Pfizer vaccine recipients, they have their two shots. And now there's talk maybe of a third. And maybe this will just be an annual thing. I don't know. What do you know about that? And have there been any papers published to justify this position? Because I just sit back and just, you know, I'm a little bit skeptical. I think, is this a means to make a little bit of extra money? It's a lot of money if you're going to vaccinate that many people. It's a lot of shots. Fill me in. It sounds like a move to almost boost their bottom line, but maybe not. Your thoughts?
Well, part of the problem we have, as we've had throughout this pandemic, is that we're still working with science that's evolving. And the idea of booster shots is really not that unusual. At least for people of my age, we remember getting booster shots for tetanus, for measles, mumps, what have you, all through our childhood. So the idea that your immune system sort of gets lowered with time and your ability to respond gets less and you need a challenge, a booster that will help rev it back up again is pretty well established. And the question is whether we're going to need to do that with these vaccines. Now, there's another piece to this, and this is really the interesting piece, and that is that these vaccines give us immunity, which is what we call humoral immunity. It's immunity in the blood. Doesn't give us immunity at the mucosal surfaces like the nose and the mouth and the eyes where the virus would come in. And so one of the things that they're working on is both a new vaccine but also a booster vaccine that would use a mucosal surface. You mentioned having it taken under your tongue like, you know, polio vaccine is taken orally. If you're taking your dog to the vet and he's got the parvo, they shoot it up his nose. It's again, a well-established technique. But a booster that would then give us the mucosal immunity, which would be wonderful because it would reduce the ability of people to be carriers, and it would give you even better defense against getting infected and getting sick. So couple of things in play there about boosters.
Yeah, so yeah, I think they'll probably marry these with a flu shot in the future, right? As a physician, a lot of doctors, a lot of healthcare workers get the flu shot all the time. A lot of school teachers have to get it. I'm assuming this will all be bundled together in the future. Is that how you see that?
If it's all an injection, it might be. You might certainly be able to get a combined vaccine, like you have the MMR.
Right.
But it might not, particularly if we have nasal or oral vaccines. Those would be different.
So, Doctor, what do you make of this mix and match COVID shots? It sounds great in theory, right?
It does sound right, and I think the reason we think it doesn't sound right is that at the very beginning we were trying to be so very careful to make sure that things went exactly as they should, and we didn't have a whole lot of overlap of data. Again, we're much farther out than we were, and so they made sure to emphasize to people that they should get both doses of the same vaccine. But I think that the possibility of mix and matching, and somebody did the experiment, is a good one because it gives us a whole lot more latitude, particularly if we have to go back, into rural areas and areas that are underserved. You take what you get, and if it doesn't have to be matched, that's so much the better.
So here's the thing. I just wonder, will this mix of matching, it'll be interesting to see what the efficacy of it is. Will it prolong immunity? Will it better protect people from, concerning variants of the coronavirus? Maybe one vaccine from one company manufacturer and another will give you a better coverage. What are your thoughts on that? Not really, or do you think it'll be something worth, at least evaluating?
Well, we will evaluate it, and we'll have the experiment to tell us. We'll have people who've been vaccinated with two doses of the same thing and with one dose of one and one of another, and we'll be able to follow them, and we'll get some answers to this. Believe me, the scientists who are involved in this are going to be very interested in tracking how this turns out.
How long does your shot last? Okay, so somebody, and these are questions that we've probably spoken about ad nauseum, but they keep coming up, and there are people who've had COVID and they feel they have natural immunity, they don't want the vaccine, or they've been around people with it. There are people who've gotten the shot. Does the shot last, I don't know, for years, for a year, for less? We're now talking boosters. What do you know? And maybe it differs by manufacturer, but fill me in.
Well, remember, we find these things out by following people over time and looking at their immunity. We haven't had a whole lot of time to follow people, so we're still in that mode of uncertainty. Certainly, we can expect it to be longer lasting than a few weeks, obviously, or we wouldn't be doing the vaccine. But it would also not be unusual to have to boost in a year, particularly if we're talking about boosting with an oral or a nasal vaccine. But we're just going to have to wait and find out. There was a very interesting study that came out that talked about the cells that are involved in this. It was looking at people who got COVID. And you may have remembered this study coming out early on that said you got COVID and then your immune system sort of declined.
Right.
And there was a question about whether or not COVID would actually give you long-term immunity. Well, now we've had enough time to follow those people to find out that, in fact, those cells go down, but they plateau and that they persist in such a state that if they're challenged again, they come right back up. And that's important. The fact that we didn't know that a year ago is just science. We just didn't know that at the time. But now we do. And there's no reason to expect that the vaccine will be a whole lot different than that.
Yeah. My guest today, Dr. Barbara Golder, and I'll go to the phones in just a quick second. So if you're on hold, I'll get you on. If you want to join us, it's 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And before I go to the calls, I just want to follow up. I would be very careful about vaccines, and we've spoken about morality and issues in the past. And then there's, of course, the physiological side effects. And some people are concerned about fertility. Some people, there was this report that has just come out talking about heart inflammation from Israel. What's with the Pfizer vaccine there? I thought they were supposed to stop inflammation. Is this just an anomaly? Or have you read the reports? Or what do you know about what's happening with the inflammation of the heart?
I have not read the reports, but I will tell you that it is well known, and we see this. It's not common And again, that's one of the reasons that we didn't see this in the trials, because the numbers are bigger when you start vaccinating the general population. But it's been known that viral illnesses can have a reaction that causes myocarditis. That's the inflammation of the heart. It can happen after flu or a common cold. We know that it happens, and it probably has something to do with an overlap of antigens on the surface of the heart cell and on the virus. Now, if that's the mechanism in this, I don't know, because, again, I haven't seen the study. But it's not surprising that we might see this and that we have seen it. And it tends to be in the same group that this is, which is young people between the ages of, like, I don't know, 15 and 30, something like that. And it tends to be males more than females. And you know, every medical examiner has seen a case like this. Every physician who's been in practice long enough has seen something like this. So it's not unheard of. But it is even within the COVID vaccination rare. Again, we're learning about it. We'll find out more, and 2 months from now, we'll know more than we do today.
So you know, there are, and again, I will be really careful about the type of stuff that I read or even say on the air. There are some world scientists who are pro-vaccine experts. They warn that the COVID-19 vaccination could change one's immune system, you know, to fight not only the virus, but, you know, other types of things, and could go on hyperdrive. But what do you know? Are there any concerns at all, or is that all internet rumor, so to speak? Have you heard any of that type of stuff? Is there any concern?
I have not. Well, there have not been reports of this happening yet. Certainly, things can go awry with the immune system. We see this with some regularity. If you'll remember, maybe 10 years ago, flu vaccine was associated with an illness called Guillain-Barré, which is an inflammation of the nerve. So we do see these things, and we have to be on the lookout for them. But that doesn't mean, A, that they're terribly common. Doesn't mean that we can't do something about them. And it's just another factor that weighs into the personal decision of whether or not you're going to take the vaccine.
Right. My guest today, Dr. Barbara Galter. And Doctor, stay with me. I'm going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll grab a call or two. And if you want to get in, the number here is 888-914-9149. Giving the latest on not just COVID-19 and the vaccines, but taking a look at vaccine passports. Are they coming? And what about HIPAA? You know, what about the need to have them just to travel here in the States with the flu season coming up in a matter of months? You know, what's going to happen then? So we'll take a look at that. And I came across a story that sounded like it was out of the future. Kind of cool. If you don't like getting needles, jabbed, poked, if you don't like that. What about a vaccine under the tongue? Polymer wafers placed under your tongue that could deliver the vaccine. Is that the future? I'll fill you in on that as well when I return.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Your voice matters. Call in now at 888-914-9149 to tell Drew what you think.
Good afternoon, Drew.
The Drew Mariani Show.
Thank you for taking my call.
On Relevant Radio.
Yeah, here to give you a look at life you won't find anywhere else. Thanks for joining me. If you're just tuning in, we are taking a look at vaccine passports, vaccine boosters, and all that you need to know about COVID-19. We're joined by Dr. Barbara Galter, and one of our favorites. She is a physician and a bioethicist and an attorney, and you want to follow her, you can check her out at ladydoclawyer.com. That is her website. And it's good to have her here with us today. And I was sharing a story, Doctor, as you were coming on, about the Danish government coming out with a digital vaccine passport so that people can start traveling in the EU for the first of the next month. Of course, there's been talk about you know, federally mandated vaccine passports here in our own country. And the White House Press Secretary, Jen Psaki, said, nah, they're off the table. But Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, he initially said he wanted to take a look at that. And I just, you know, I wonder a couple questions here, because you're both an attorney and a physician. You know, HIPAA is such a big thing. You can't go, you know, see your spouse unless, you know, they sign off on your documents when you go to the hospital. Yet some greeter at a church or somebody in a bar could say, show me your vaccine, you know, that you've been vaccinated. And I just grapple with that a little bit. Is this a little bit different? And maybe it is. When I travel internationally, I have no problem showing my vaccination card, my Hep A, my typhoid, my cholera, whatever vaccination I have, right? So, I mean, help me work through that. I mean, what's the deal with that? Are people worried about their privacy and their health? I mean, there's some people who may not want to reveal whether they had the shot or not.
Yeah, people have all kinds of reasons for liking or not liking this, and they're as varied as people are. HIPAA actually applies to the retaining and transmitting of healthcare information. So, for example, I as a physician have medical records on you that has identifying information about you and about your health.
Right.
I have certain responsibilities about how I keep that safe,
right,
so it's not shared, and the people to whom I share it. For example, I can't show it to anybody without your permission, specific permission, to share it. So HIPAA applies to that. Now, the greeter at the door is not gaining and retaining information. He's looking at a card. And so it's not kept. So it falls into a slightly different category. Do they need to be discreet about sharing that stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Of course. And I suspect there will be some lawsuits that try to define how that should be done. But it's important to understand this is a slightly different situation than HIPAA. What's going to be interesting is that without a federal vaccine passport left to the states, it's going to create some interesting situations. Florida, for example, has said you can't have vaccine passports. Some other states have said we will have them, we'll permit them. And those states that permit them can permit them internally, but then there'll be a question about whether they can require them of people coming into the state. It's going to be a very interesting situation that I suspect will take a number of lawsuits and will probably go to the Supreme Court before we figure out what we can and can't do. But the reality is those passports are a little bit different beast than than a medical record.
You know, I get that because that's what I grappled with. I'm like, hey, I show my vaccination card when I travel overseas, so you know it's. How does this vary? And I wonder if it'll come to U.S. travel at some point. If the fall comes around and the flu is out or we get another round of some variant of COVID-19, if airlines will say, hey, you can only get on the plane if you've been vaccinated. You know, who knows what we'll see. And you might need to identify whether or not you've been vaccinated or not. So,
well, and it will certainly apply to international travel.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Because if you're going someplace that requires the passport, it's like having your passport ready before you travel to England. They need to know that you have it.
Yep.
So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But it's going to be interesting from the standpoint of a lawyer watching it. From the standpoint of somebody trying to figure out what to do with traveling, it's going to be frustrating.
Right. Well, let's do this. Let's grab a couple of calls. I do want to talk to you about the vaccination under the tongue. I'm super excited about that. But let me start in Munster, Indiana. Ken is listening there, and he's got a question for you. Hi, Ken. Good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, two questions. One is I've already had COVID, and it was about a year ago, and I had active resistance antibodies 8-9 months afterwards. I haven't had it tested since, but the reason I bring that up is there's a lot of studies indicating that natural resistance may last a very long time, even a lifetime, so do I really need a vaccine? And then my second question is, I'm getting a lot of pressure to get the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And is there any evidence, any studies suggesting any type of adverse reaction between somebody with natural immunity and the vaccine?
Great question.
Let me take the second one first because it's easier. I am not aware of any studies that indicate there are any different kinds of reaction if you've had COVID than if you haven't. It would be like getting a booster shot or being exposed to the virus again. Now, that may change, and I may have missed a study, but that's my understanding at this point.
Okay.
With respect to natural immunity, that was sort of what I was talking about when I was talking about checking the cells and watching them and of course, then checking for antibodies. There was some question about how COVID immunity would last, and there's some indication that it may also be a different problem in terms of different people responding differently. So you may have very good immunity that lasts for years and years and someone else may not. So it may be a little bit difficult to say for any particular person, but we can say in general that we're getting some good evidence that, in fact, natural immunity lasts a pretty good long time and is a good thing. And then the question comes up, why do we get a vaccine for a disease that has such a high survival rate? And the answer is, if you're going to get to herd immunity in this country without vaccination, it's going to cost about 6 million lives.
Wow.
And that's the reason. Because when you start talking about the whole population having to get infected to come to the point where we got a manageable way of doing this, that's why the vaccine program is important. Now, does somebody who's had COVID need to be vaccinated? Again, the jury's out. If you have good antibody response 8 months later, probably not. But if you don't, perhaps you do. And that's a question you take up with your physician. Yeah. You can test for antibodies and make that decision yourself. So I hope I gave you the pieces to answer that question.
Yeah.
I tried.
Thank you.
Yep. All right. Hey, Ken, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And Jake has a question for you, too. He's my board operator and producer on the show today. And go ahead. Jump in.
Hey, doctor. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not sure. This is something I'm going to admit. I don't know if it's true. I've just heard this question floated to me that the vaccine is not necessarily limiting the spread to other people. The only thing it's doing is limiting your own symptoms. So I just wanted to clarify that.
And there's some truth to that. Certainly, the vaccine reduces your ability to spread the virus one person to another. If you're vaccinated, you're less likely to spread it. Mm-hmm. But you can be what we call colonized, which is you have the virus in your mucosal surfaces, but you don't get sick. And the point of the vaccine is to keep you from getting sick as well as reducing spread. Now, this is why the vaccines that go in the nasal cavity or in the mouth are important, because they can, in fact, prevent colonization, because you get the mucosal immunity, the virus shows up, and it gets knocked out, and you become even less likely to transmit the disease. So that's why that's really an exciting thing.
So let's pick up on that point. I mean, I love the thought of not having the have a needle stuck in my arm, right, or any other part of my body. But having something placed under your tongue, explain that. How close are we to that, and is that the future of vaccinations in the country?
Well, certainly we've had other vaccines, as I indicated. You remember the polio sugar cube thing. And again, veterinary medicine, the parvovirus or the kennel cough, I guess, is done that way. So we've had the technology, and the question is whether or not any particular virus is suitable for that technology. So, yeah, I do think it's the wave of the future, particularly for viruses that mucosal immunity is important for. And that's really, I mean, it's good that we have this injectable vaccine, but if we can get this, it will make it so much easier to manage this disease and to get vaccinations widespread and easily available.
Any idea how close we are?
No, they didn't give me a crystal ball today.
I wish I had one. I'd love that.
Me too. But I know that in a meeting a few months ago, they had a huge meeting in New York, and they were already talking about getting these things in trials. So. Yeah. It's not that far away.
The next call, she's got a question about something I also read, and it just sounds kind of bizarre to me, but let's entertain it. Lydia is listening in Wisconsin. Lydia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Yes, I saw a video about magnets sticking to the vaccinated person's arm, and I have a lot of friends that have been vaccinated, so I've been trying it, and every one of them, the magnets stick to the arm that is vaccinated as well. I'm starting to find underneath the collarbone, right in the center. I just want to know why. It's driving me crazy.
Yeah, I saw that report, Lydia.
I have tons.
When I saw your call on the screen, I thought, oh, I heard that. I thought that was just, I didn't believe it could possibly be true.
It is true.
But doctor, fill us in. I mean, why are magnets sticking to people's arms who've been vaccinated?
I'm going to have to pass on that one because I haven't read the article. If you could send it to me, I'd be fascinated in it. And if there's a way for me to get back to you, Lydia, I'd be glad to talk with you about it. But I can think of absolutely no explanation for that.
Yeah.
off the top of my head, and I'd really, really have to see that article to be able to make sense
Lydia,
out of it.
I'll put you on hold. Maybe Jay can get the email for Dr.
Sure.
Golder, and maybe you can forward that. Or send it to me, too, okay? I'd love to read that. Yeah, it's one of those bizarre things. I thought, that's not true. Come on. Really? Magnets sticking to somebody's arm? But here Lydia says, no, I've tried it with everybody I know, and it works. I don't know how powerful the magnet is or what would account for something like that, but that's something else. All right, let's go back to the phones. We will we'll go to who's up next, guys? Ann in Chicago. Ann, good afternoon. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Drew, for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just had a comment about the whole wafer vaccine. I find it kind of eerie comparison with the whole Eucharist. Just wondering if it's more of a mocking our religion, with the Eucharist being obviously the antidote for eternal life, and now this COVID vaccine being a wafer for
thanks, Ann. I don't think there's anything deliberate there, but Doctor, I'll let you answer that. You're the physician.
No, I think not. I think one of the things we have to remember about these people who go into this branch of science to deal with vaccines and pandemic illnesses and developing things for health, so they do it to help people. They don't do it to mock them or to or to denigrate them in any way. It just so happens, and again, we've had sublingual, that means underneath the tongue, medications for a long time, nitroglycerin.
Doctor, I got to hold you right there. I hate to cut you off. We've got that email for you, so stand by, okay? I'm out of time for the day. Wish I had more time to hang out with you. I'll talk to you tomorrow.